Welcome to another Early Years Learning Hub podcast. My name is Jackie Ward and I'm the founder and managing director of the Early Years Learning Hub. And this is the first in our Unpacking Theory and Research series, where I invite academics, researchers and experts to tell us about what the theory, research or contemporary understandings mean for our day-to-day practice and our work as teachers, educators and leaders. This episode is about practice architecture and what it means for how we develop as professionals and the sorts of conditions that high quality practice. I am super delighted to be joined by Dr. Mandy Cook and Dr. Leanne Gibbs, and they are here to talk us about all of their research and their work in this practice architecture space. Mandy, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself, your background and your professional journey?
Sure. Thanks, Jackie. So I have been a teacher, educator for a very long time. I initially did an undergraduate degree in primary teaching, and so taught in primary schools for about 13 years, and then realised I really wanted to know where the children were coming from when they came into my prep class. And so I went back to university and studied early childhood education and have not left, realising that that was the place that I was to belong for the rest of my career. So I continued teaching in early childhood education for about another 15 years before moving into academia through the pathway of doing my PhD with Leanne.
Awesome. Great segue.
Hello, I'm Leanne, and like Mandy, I started in practice, which is one of the reasons why we draw so closely to the theory of practice architectures, which we'll talk about today. And my history was, really, I started out as an early childhood teacher, and I always say I wasn't a particularly good early childhood teacher, and that's why I admire early childhood teachers so much, is because they do an amazing job. But what I did find I was pretty good at was working with others in leadership roles. And so I guess my early, you know, I moved fairly early into leadership roles and professional learning roles, and have had that experience over the years of leading organisations, leading programs. And then I got to the point where, yes, like Mandy, I thought a PhD might be a great idea, and was very lucky to join Charles Sturt University to undertake that PhD, and that's how Mandy and I met and have forged a fantastic relationship since.
That sounds exciting. I always like for people to share their journeys, because I think it's, you know, you get a lot of questions, I think, from the sector about where can I go to, or where, you know, what's a possible career trajectory. And so it's interesting, I think, to hear, well, how did you sort of come to this place in your journey? So that's great. So one of the reasons why I reached out to you both is that I'm really interested and fascinated in this concept of practice architecture, but I don't know if I quite have my head around it properly. First of all, wanted to ask you, what is it all about? What's the theory of practice architecture?
Well, the great thing is that we can talk endlessly about this, Jackie, and you might decide that you want to kind of cut back to it. A shorter version, not the four-hour version that Mandy and I are really happy to talk with you about. But just before we go forward, the theory of practice architectures has an S on the end of it. So that's something that we always kind of make sure that we bring people back to, is that it's the theory of practice architectures. And that means that there are a significant range of architectures that enable and constrain practice. But Mandy is really good at explaining the practice perspective, so I'm going to throw to her first.
Okay, so I'm going to try and give a succinct overarching explanation of the theory, which is quite difficult, but I will give it my best go. So the theory of practice architectures is a practice theory, and it was developed by educators with a focus on education. So that's really exciting, because not all theories are specifically education focused, and this one really does have a strong focus. And what the theory suggests is that the purpose of education is to help people to live well in a world worth living in, which I think is a really lovely place to start for a theory, with a big overarching aim for people and for a sustainable and happy world. And so what the theory does is it provides a really comprehensive framework for helping us to achieve this purpose of education, and for to do that by looking at practices. But not just practices, it also provides a framework for looking at the conditions, both within and brought to education settings, that shape and influence practices. So the two really key main parts of the theory are this notion of practices and practice architectures being the conditions. And so the practices are seen to be made up of sayings, doings, and relatings. And the practice architectures are made up of cultural, discursive, material, economic, and social political arrangements or conditions. And so these sayings, doings, and relatings interact with the practice architectures or these arrangements in a kind of interrelated dance to influence and shape and affect each other. So, for example, the cultural discursive arrangements might be a policy or a philosophy, and these can influence the sayings that educators say, so the words that educators use within their practices. Policies might also, or philosophy might also, influence the doings and the relatings of practices, so the physical actions that educators enact and the ways that they interact and the relationships that unfold within practices. So, as I said, it's this sort of really interrelated dance of arrangements and practices influencing each other to shape the way practices unfold within education settings. Now, practices and practice architectures are the two big main parts of the theory, but there are also some other elements, such as looking at practice histories and practice landscapes, and teachers' and educators' dispositions. And so all of these elements help us to look at practices in a really holistic way. So we're not just looking at what one individual teacher does, but we're looking at this kind of complex interplay between what all the people in the settings say, do, and how they relate, and how those conditions brought to them within the setting influence it, the way these sayings, doings, and relatings unfold. And so this complex framework, well, complex, but once you get your head around it, it's quite, I think it can be quite simple. All of this framework really helps us to come back to that purpose of education, and in figuring out what practices we can and should enact to help children and families to live well in a world worth living in.
That's very interesting. I guess that's really explained it a little bit more for me, and that idea and kind of how it l relates, I guess, to intentional teaching. And as you mentioned, Leanne, that there are multiple sort of architectures, or mo I'm guessing multiple influences as well. So that's really helped me, I guess, to understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I guess, why do you guys think this is important for educators, teachers, and leaders to understand? Like, why is that sort of significant, I guess?
It's so significant because when we look at practices, we can look at it and we can say that is what we see, or that is what we do. We realize the practice of the sayings in the cognitive space and in the language that we use. We realize the doings within the material space in the way our action and what we're actually doing, and as Mandy explained, in the relatings. But it's actually about the transformation of practices that we see. So the practices themselves are obviously important, but it's actually what enables and transforms those practices. And this is where we get into the practice architectures. So we're looking at those practices being enabled and constrained. So it's not enabled or constrained, but enabled and constrained by the three dimensions, the three arrangements, which are the cultural discursive arrangements, the material economic arrangements, and the social political arrangements. So it's those things that actually shape the practices and enable and constrain the practices. So whilst we look at the practices themselves, and we see the individual within those practices, it's actually not possible for that practice to be realized without all of those arrangements around it. So if I can give an example to make this a bit clearer, is that where we've got, for example, a leader who has their practices, their sayings, doings and relatings, but they're not just an individual within that. They're being shaped by the cultural discursive arrangements. What sort of language and culture do we have within an organisation that shapes their practices of leading? What are the material resources that shape their practices of leading? And what are the social political arrangements that shape, enable and constrain their practices of leading? So what I love about the theory of practice architectures is it really shows that the practices are only as good as the arrangements that are around them. So, you know, when we look at someone's practice and we say if they just tried harder, if they just did this better. But in actual fact, there are a lot of things around those practices that are enabling and constraining them. So it's not possible to try harder unless we look at all of those arrangements around that practice and look at transformation of practice.
That hones in a really good point, doesn't it, to think if you're sort of wanting to make a change in your setting that you need to think about all of those sorts of things. You know, what's the organisational systems and structures to support or, you know, discourage you, I guess, from doing something. And also, you know, that idea of, I was also sort of thinking too about, you know, when you guys were both talking about this, about assessment and rating and that idea that, you know, quality practice is evidenced in lots of different ways. And I think that's not always maybe well perceived or well understood by educators, you know, that it's not just, but I've written this here and that's an example of critical reflection, meaningful engagement, embedded practice. It's actually a lot of different things that give you a picture of quality at a service.
Exactly, Jackie. And you know, you look at something like the practice of intentional teaching, which you just talked about. But what about the vision of the service? What's actually, you know, what's actually underpinning that practice of intentional teaching, where the whole team has come together and developed the vision and the philosophy and their language and the culture around that vision? It really comes back to this much bigger picture of what a practice represents, but how that practice is made possible. And it's just not possible to try harder, right?
I think what's great about the theory is it takes the focus away from individual teachers and educators. Like Leanne saying, we can't just try harder. That's not what it's about. And so taking that focus away from the individual and saying this is about the whole setting and about the influencing factors outside of the setting. For example, the version 2 of the Early Years Learning Framework is a cultural discursive arrangement that is influencing the way everybody in every setting is enacting their practices. And the focus is on the practice, not the teacher. And so the judgments about, you know, when people are working through their quality improvement plan, we do see sometimes that there is personal individual judgment on teachers. You know, the teacher in that room is really good, so when the assessor and rater comes, we'll send them in there. It's not about the individuals, it's about the practices. And so, as Leanne was saying, it's about the overarching vision of the setting and what are the practices that are being encouraged and shaped and enabled through the arrangements within the setting.
Yeah, that is awesome. That is really important. And I think, I guess we've talked about this already, but educators' beliefs matter and the culture and expectations of your setting matter. Have you guys got anything more to say about that?
Yeah, plenty. Yeah, so, you know, I guess we have educators who come to settings and they come with their own sets of values and beliefs about children and about it, and they may have studied at a particular university that has a way of thinking or a registered training organization or whatever, so they come already with all of these foundational beliefs. But when they move into an early childhood setting, there's also a set of beliefs that have been created within the early childhood setting, and that could be because the whole team preferably has worked on the vision. But what's important here is not necessarily that the beliefs and values of the educator are exactly the same as the beliefs of the, you know, the vision, although it is very helpful. But if we're looking at the changing practices, we've got to think about what sort of language are we using. Now, we know how important language is when we talk about children, when we talk about early childhood education and care. So what's the language, what's embedded in the culture of the service in terms of language? What's embedded in the culture of the service in terms of respect for each other, respect for children? And these elements of culture are, you know, endemic within an early childhood setting. So the educator comes into the setting with their own set of beliefs, and then they're initiated or stirred into the practices of the early childhood setting according to those arrangements that sit around them. So, you know, it's where we see fundamentally that culture is respectful of children, respectful of each other, feels particular ways about early childhood education. That's, I guess, the arrangements within which that educator comes.
I would just jump in there to say too that I think that's really, really crucial. You know, I follow a lot of social media groups to sort of get an idea of what people are interested in and needing help with and whatnot. And I see that, you know, a lot of people talk about a workplace and that they've got challenges and all sorts of things. And I would definitely encourage people to think about finding a workplace that does align with their core ideas and values, rather than sort of thinking that they have to acquiesce to wherever the of the organisation that they're working with, because the places do exist that I think align with everybody's kind of niche. And I know as a practitioner myself, it feels amazing to work with a team that's kind of where you're working like a synchronised swimming team, you know, where everyone's kind of got the routine and it's just everything flows. You can get into a zone really easily and it's a great place to work for a million other reasons, but that idea that you're all on the same page.
Yeah, and I think one of the elements of that is understanding what good practice looks like as well, what a good environment looks like, because if this is your first experience of working in an early childhood setting, how do you know that that's good practice? How do you understand that this is a good environment to be in? And that's sometimes why we see young educators leave the sector early, only after a couple of years of being in early childhood education and care, because their experience, you know, you're saying, well, there are those places that exist and you can go and find them, but what if you don't know they're there? What if we don't understand what good practice is? What if we don't know what a good organisation is? So that's a key element of understanding practice. And I think we're going to be talking about professional identity at some stage, so that we can talk more about
into
that.
Mandy, do you have anything to add into that
comment? I guess just going back to that notion of finding a place to work that resonates with you. And I think it's really important in the sector that, yes, there are good practices, absolutely, and it's important to be able to recognise what they look like. But good practice in one setting is not necessarily good practice in another setting. And this is one of the things the theory of practice architectures really focuses in on, is that every setting is different. And that the arrangements that work for that setting and the practices that are enacted in that setting will be different depending on the community and the context. So, for example, if you've got a setting in Alice Springs and a setting in Sydney or in rural Victoria, they're all going to be very, very different. And so they're going to have a different vision and a different philosophy. So if you take a teacher from Sydney, for example, and they move to Alice Springs, they're going to need to be more open to a different set of practices, a different set of practice architectures that influence those practices. And so when you are looking for places to work, and you know, we're in a climate at the moment where we do have a workforce shortage, and so for people looking for places to work, to really understand the vision and the philosophy of that centre, and trying to find somewhere that they're aligned to, but also being open to different practices and different architectures because of the context and the setting. And I think that's so exciting that, you know, you might go and work in a rural or a regional setting that's going to be very, very different to a city-based setting, but it's going to offer some really rich different experiences.
Yes, I love that about the inclusion of, or, you know, the reference to place-based pedagogy in the updated early years learning framework and My Time, Our Place. You know, that reminder to us that our practices will look different, you know, in different contexts with different communities and different makeup and all that kind of stuff. So that is awesome. I think we sort of, I guess we've touched on this a little bit, but where you work matters, quality practice can be impacted. So I think sometimes maybe one of the reasons why people experience burnout is because they do get frustrated if they're trying to implement or they're trying to change practice and the, you know, it doesn't seem to be happening. But sometimes I think without realizing it, they don't realize it's those system level things that are impacting on them. I guess, have you guys got any thoughts around that and, you know, your research and your chats with, you know, services and educators?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that the theory of practice architectures really helps us to zoom in on, Well, there are a lot of different elements of practice that it helps us look at, but one of them in particular is the practice landscape, and that helps us to look at, I guess, in most simplest terms, how have things always been done here? And so often, I think when teachers and educators go into new settings and they do try to change practice, they butt up against, well, that's how we've always done things here. And that can be difficult to change the culture of that. And so the theory helps us to zoom in on that. Why have things always been done like that? Is that still relevant in today's society or in that context, in that setting? Things may have changed, and so that what has always been done may no longer be relevant. So that's what I really love about the theory, is that there are so many different elements to it, and it provides us a way of zooming in on different elements at different times and in different ways to really unpack and explore all of the reasons why practice may be happening the way it is, and as Leanne said earlier, how we can transform practice collaboratively as a community rather than individuals trying to change practice in a silo and in conditions that may not be willing to see that change take place.
And it could even be something like, you know, the governance practices within an organisation about, for example, how the budget allocates professional learning and, you know, professional learning budgets and the way that people are encouraged to engage in professional learning. And that, you know, it's something as simple as maybe giving people a choice about, we're not just sending you off to do the professional learning we want you to do, you can choose, you know, you can choose your focus. And we're not even going to ask you what it is. Here's your money for your professional learning, and you might find something really interesting that is brings you back to be inspired in your practice here. So, you know, something simple like autonomy over how you conduct your own learning could have an influence on practice.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because that's something that is often something that people battle with, isn't it? Well, I've got it. Well, even in New South Wales, Nessa was telling us what our priorities were, which is great now that we don't have that as well. We can just recognise that as professionals, we can choose our own professional learning. So that is definitely, you know, it's probably naturally going to happen that people's professional learning is going to align with the direction that the service is heading if there's that autonomy anyway, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Things will happen naturally. Reminded constantly over the years where I've sort of often thought in my own practice, am I allowed to do that? Or am I? So often the control is within ourselves, isn't it? You know, I'm not sure if that's the right thing to do, or, you know, so talking about this theory and unpacking it as a team really gives us sort of, I guess, permission to question that together and, you know, who is making the decisions and who do we want to make the decisions? Because there's a lot of things that are up to our own sort of free will, if you like, but we haven't realised that autonomy ourselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm, definitely. And the theory, you know, is we talk about, you know, that democracy, I suppose, and about, well, that word can be misused as well, but we talk about it in terms of practice and how we have some of that autonomy and have the right to be a part of the decision making as well. So, you know, it is really important, because compliance is a big part of early childhood education, but it is not the only part. It is not the path. So we need to be thinking broadly about our own professional identity as practitioners as well.
Yeah, definitely. And that's nice, a nice segue. Let's talk about professionalism and professional identity. One of the things that I'm really hoping that we'll eradicate from the vernacular of early childhood educators is industry. Mm-hmm. So every time I hear it, I mean, we're not producing little tiny people. We're, you know, we're educating and caring for them. So what are your thoughts around this and what have you sort of uncovered that's important?
I'd like to talk briefly about the material economic arrangements of early childhood education and care, because I think this sometimes definitely feeds into that notion of professionalism and identity, but is sometimes overlooked. As I said at the beginning, I began my career as a primary school teacher, and then when I moved into early childhood, there were some really significant things that I saw different between primary settings and early childhood settings in terms of the material economic arrangements. And so when we look at material economic arrangements, we look at things like the way the classrooms are set out, the way the physical space is arranged. And one of the things that I do notice in some early childhood settings is that there's not great staff facilities. For example, a staff room. You know, you go into some settings and the staff room is also the resource cupboard and the planning room, and everything's very crammed in together. Whereas if you go into a primary or a secondary school, there are very dedicated staff room facilities with kitchens, and there are planning rooms and really dedicated spaces for the things that the organisation wants to see happening in that environment. And I think it's really important that in early childhood education and care settings that organisations are looking at what are the physical arrangements that help early childhood educators and teachers, and I keep deliberately using the term educators and teachers because we do have both in the settings, to help them feel like they are professionals with a strong professional identity. And if you're asked to do planning sitting next to someone who's eating their Thai takeout for lunch, then I think that's not setting our people up for being professionals and to have a strong professional identity. So the material economic arrangements of the physical space are really important as a very base level. And let's not start talking about wages. I mean, obviously, that's a big one and we're all aware of that. But we often say paying conditions and then we perhaps don't talk in detail about what we mean by conditions. And I think conditions that can set us up to feel like professionals is really, really important.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And in my previous job, I worked with, our early learning team, which was the early childhood space, and then the primary and the secondary. And there's lots of difference, I think, particularly in what you guys talked about with the language, the sayings, and, you know, like it, even the difference between primary and secondary was quite significant in lots of different ways. And I was like very interested to notice that across the education continuum. And also, I guess it made me, you know, when I was in that space, feel a lot more proud of myself as an early childhood professional, because whilst there's lots of things that happen in those other spaces, we are quite, you know, the way our curriculum framework is set up, we're making a lot of decisions, we're making a lot of, you know, I guess, you know, we're implementing pedagogy and curriculum that's really created from ourselves, you know, so we should be, I think, well respected as the most significant of all of the teachers and educators. That's just my opinion.
I agree with you absolutely, Jackie, and I think that this is, Mandy and I have been going backwards and forwards with the idea of early childhood education or early childhood education and care, and we've probably landed on early childhood education and care again. We've come back to that. It does acknowledge and recognise the unique nature of the work that we do. And I'm really coming round to much more of this thinking of, which doesn't say my thesis, but anyway, let's just forget about that. I'm coming round to the thinking and to this work around, let's just separate ourselves out, right? Let's just show that uniqueness and demonstrate that we're actually better than everybody else at this, because... and resist the testing regimes, resist this overt assessment of children, because that's not what it's about. That is not, certainly we are working towards the whole child, or the child's whole when they come to us anyway, but early childhood education does a whole range of things. It's about civic, children who, as they grow older, have better employment prospects, better academic outcomes, but they're also better at contributing in the community as well. They're more healthy, you know, so that requires a whole range of professional skills and professional identity, and we really need to claim that and stop kind of trying to be like everybody else, because we're not. We're absolutely not. And I remember when I was presenting on my research, and Fran Press, who was my supervisor, and I went to the UK and we presented at this conference, and it was one of my big goals to present at a conference that was a non-early childhood conference on leadership. And we had a whole range of people from a whole range of professions, right to the army. And at the conclusion of our presentation, there were a few tears and people said, "This is how we want leadership to be. This is how it, you know." And they were convinced that this was the future of leadership. And I think that's the way we need to be thinking, because the way that early childhood education and care professionals do their work is unique. It is groundbreaking. It is really amazing. And so it's claiming that space and claiming that professional identity and being proud of it.
I couldn't agree more, and I think one of the reasons why we probably think those other spaces, you know, in education are a bit more professional is there's a lot of use of jargon. But if you sort of break that down a little bit and you realise that, you know, whatever they might be talking about, instructional text, oh, that's just talking about, you know, the procedure for a recipe or whatever, you know, so it's breaking it down and, you know, but I do think that's an area where we could definitely grow in terms of, you know, translating and sort of summarising the early years learning outcomes and the key components a little bit more for families to sort of connect that or make that learning visible, you know. I think that's definitely could be strengthened in our sayings, but yeah, I do think we've got it all going on. I'm just worried that I didn't give you a chance if you've got anything else to add there, Mandy.
Lots of things that just flashed through my mind and now they seem to have gone.
Well, that's okay. You can come back to it. But there's two more things that I wanted to talk about. I know that you've sort of your area of expertise, Leanne, is leadership enablers. And Mandy, you've got a sort of special focus on risk-taking enablers. So I just thought we could finish up on those two things. So I guess we were just talking about leadership. Would you like to talk about leadership enablers, Leanne?
Yeah, and this was obviously what my PhD research was, but it's also been, you know, really part of my, I suppose, my whole history in early childhood education is trying to figure out how we cultivate leadership, how we encourage leadership in others, and how we lead. And of course, the connection between leading and the theory of practice architectures is a beautiful one as well. So looking at the practices of leading and those being open to everybody, whether they're in a positional role or whether they're in an educator role, room leader role. And that's not saying that everybody's a leader in a positional sense, but it is talking about the practices of leading, which are, you know, these socially just practices of respecting children, working with families, communicating well, understanding visions and being able to communicate the vision of early childhood education. But how do you actually enable that? Because that's high quality practice. So how do we enable that sort of practice, and how do we enable the practices of leading? And this is where the architectures, the arrangements come in. So we have a culture and language around leading that doesn't separate out people and only make people who are in positional leadership have the capacity to lead. You know, others can practice leading, and I think some of the best settings are those that share the interesting roles around where people have expertise and then they're leading in their practices, which is very different to distributed leadership, and I won't go into that today, but that's a good focus for another discussion. And what are the material economic arrangements that support people to lead and have the practices of leading? Well, it might be as simple as how the room is set up, how people can make decisions around the resources that they use because they're at hand. They don't have to go to another room and find those. They can lead practice in that way. The sorts of things that Mandy's saying about good rooms to to have a break and do those things. That's building people's capacity and confidence as well to lead. And then the social political arrangements. How are staff meetings conducted? Is there an equality of contribution in those staff meetings that enables people to lead as well? So it's not just cultivating leadership, but it's cultivating the practices of leading. And the argument there is that if we do have strong practices of leading within an early childhood setting, the organisation is enabling those practices, but everybody's doing the heavy lifting around leadership and everybody's contributing to the purpose of that early childhood setting.
That's awesome. I love that idea too, that everyone can, you know, we don't, there's lots of, you know, talk out there to say that, you know, people don't want to take on positional leadership roles or whatever, but leading work is really different. And I think that sort of notion of leading work can tend to, or ideas or notions or concepts or, you know, initiatives, whatever it is in your workplace, can, I think, give yourself that sort of purpose and joy in your work if you're excited and it's based on your interests and strengths, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And can I just give one example of how that works?
Yes, please.
Because I know sometimes when we're talking about all these abstract concepts, they kind of merge into each other and it's hard to understand. But here's an example. So an educator who's not in a positional leadership role, a family walks through the door in the day and really needs to have access to early childhood education and care. And they really need to have a space for that child. But the centre is full and it's not possible to have that child have a space. But, and the director's away, by the way, they're away somewhere else. They're a meeting some other place. But that educator knows a few things. They know about their enrolment process. So, and they know about the regulations. So these are all arrangements that are around this setting. They also know that one of the great intentions of that setting is social justice and equality of access for families who really need it. And they also know a little bit about the regulations that tells them that in actual fact we can take one more child because we can go over numbers here for this special case. So all of this knowledge, all of these skills and all of these values that this educator has and all of the arrangements around them, which also means that when they make this decision they're going to be supported, means that that family has a place very soon. And that is the practice of leading there. They've led in their everyday practice. They haven't been in a leadership role, but there are all of these arrangements around them that support them in that practice.
That's a really good example and such a contentious one with all the regs and other things. And also the director not getting cross if they did make that decision. I think it's a really good one to enable people really to take, you know, initiative and lead the way in their work. That's a goodie. All right. Is there anything you have to add on that, Mandy, before we jump into your...
Well, I was just thinking about some... Leanne and I often talk about crossovers between our work, and I can see a big crossover there just based on your comment, Jackie, that about the director not getting cross because that person took the initiative to lead in that situation. And, of course, my work is on risk-taking, and I really like to think that educator, that teacher, didn't feel like they were taking a risk by doing that because they felt confident that the conditions and the architectures around their work was that they had a supportive leader who was going to support their decisions and the actions that they took in that situation.
That's awesome. That is good. It's funny, you know, that I'm actually thinking of a very similar example in my practice. Last year, we did have the room because we'd had some children leave, but in my organisation, it was kind of, we didn't take on new enrolments later in the year. So I sort of, you know, had tried to find a spot for that family because there were some issues in the service that they felt they needed to leave. So it's funny. That's, you know, one of the reasons, I guess, why I've said something like that. But it's great to think that there is a space where people are afforded that, you know, confidence in decision making and all of those sorts of things. Taking some risks. I love it.
Yes.
Yeah. Over to you.
Okay. So it's always important when I start to talk about my work is to talk about what do I mean by risk taking. And as we said at the beginning about practice architectures, I could talk about this for a really long time, so I'll give you the short version. So when I talk about risk-taking in education settings, I'm talking about what I term pedagogical risk-taking. So it's risk-taking that has a positive intention. So an intention to do something that will have either a positive or successful outcome, or if it's not a, what we would term a successful outcome, that there are positive learnings from the, for lack of a better word, from the failure or from things not working out the way you hoped they would. So I'm not talking about risky behaviours. I'm not talking about skydiving and running across the road in front of cars. And I'm not talking about hazards that might put children in harm's way. So that's really important to be clear about that. And we're really lucky in Australia because our early years learning framework does talk about risk taking. It's very clear that we want to encourage children to have opportunities to take risks in all aspects of their learning. Now, sometimes this is termed risky play. Risky play is generally described as an outdoor activity, although it does take place indoors as well, but it's mostly a very physical experience. And it's the one that most people think about when we talk about risk-taking in early childhood, climbing trees, using hammers, those sorts of things. In my work, I look at a much broader range of risk-taking. So for children, looking at social and emotional and cognitive risk-taking, but also looking at risk-taking for teachers and educators. And so coming back to the previous conversation, educators doing things that step them outside of their comfort zone with the intention of transforming practice in positive ways. So my work is very aligned with the overarching aim of the theory of practice architectures, to transform practice for better. And as I said with Leanne's example, I would really hope that that person enacting a leading practice didn't feel like it was risk-taking. But in reality, we know that sometimes there are teachers and educators in centres who do need to step out of their comfort zone to do things to advocate for children, for families, and for each other. And so I do really focus a lot on what are the conditions within centres that enable both children and teachers or educators to do things that really work towards democracy and social justice and developing themselves in a holistic way, I guess, as confident professionals with a strong professional identity. And so we look at things like the philosophy of the centre. Does that really clearly articulate that the centre promotes and encourages children and educators to take risks? And so some of the centres that I've worked with for my research, they do exactly that. They explicitly state it in their philosophy. They have words, images in their, for example, on their website or in their other documentation that really explicitly state that they promote that. And then they have resources and physical arrangements within the setting that really promote that. And so things like coming back to the physical arrangements of a staff room or a planning room, places where teachers and educators can go together and have professional conversations about their pedagogy and how they are providing opportunities for children to take risks and whether that feels risky for them themselves. And if it does, how can they work together to support each other to scaffold their own learning and their own sense of confidence in doing things that might feel a little bit risky.
Yes, I'm reminded of a lot of people that I think, you know, sometimes they're a bit risk averse because they're sort of got this fear, I guess, you know, the regulations and that unknown of not really knowing whether or not that is possible or isn't, you know, that question comes up a lot in you know, discussion forums and in people's practice that I chat to about the idea of, are we allowed to do that or is that, you know, permissible, or is that what's the reg say about that particular thing, you know? So I often talk about that idea of empowering yourself and being sort of open to risk taking when you know and understand what the requirements are. Well, you are then equipped to make your own professional judgments about things, and you can take those risks because you know that if you've got the risk assessment in place, if you've got this, if you've done that, you know, you've ticked off all the things that help support your accountability and your responsibilities, and you can sort of move forward a little bit with confidence.
Absolutely, Jackie. I think that's so important that, and I guess this is again where mine and Leanne's work intersects, is that I think in some centres the climate is, I'm not sure what the regulation is, so I'm just going to ask somebody, usually the centre director, and rely on what they tell me. And then that becomes the law within the setting as to what we're allowed to do or not to do. And I think that in order to all be leaders and all be risk takers, that we do need to know where to find the regulations. And then, I mean, they're complicated, they're tricky, and we're all really busy. And so, but I think that foundational work to know where they are, to understand them and be able to go and find the answers to the questions in print ourselves is absolutely important, because that's what enables and empowers us to make decisions for ourselves rather than relying on other people to tell us yes, you can, or no, you can't.
Well, it's inherent in the sort of, you know, what we talk about then too, isn't it? In the sayings of what we do, because we can then speak to that in terms of if it's an authorised officer visiting on a spot check or an assessment and rating visit, you know, these are the decisions that we made because of these things. These are steps that we took to, you know, check in, clarify, develop plans, all those sorts of things. You can really talk to what you're doing because you've been actively involved in the process.
And it only becomes adversarial if one person wants to be right.
Yeah, definitely. Well, they are a bit, open to interpretation, some of those regulations, aren't they?
They are, but then it's actually having those conversations about it, about the regs, and talking those through and just being all over them, basically.
And I love the fact that, you know, you've sort of, we're finishing on this note, if you like, because for me, in my practice, I think every time that I do take some risks, even though I've had, I can't even tell you how many failures, including doing some cooking experiences, you know, when I was casual teaching in a school with, you know, lots of children with some additional needs that ended up in, you know, thermonuclear level disaster. But, you know, at the end of the day, children really did enjoy the experience and benefited from those learning, you know. And I think about doing woodwork with children and, you know, the downside is obviously that someone might hurt themselves and, you know, hammer their thumb or whatever. But the other side of it is that, you know, these children are really getting to experience all these really magnificent learning experiences. So, it matters.
Definitely. I think one of the things that I talk about, because I've realised over my years working in this space, is that risk-taking, the term risk-taking, looking at the sayings of practice, can feel a bit intimidating and people get a bit worried about that. But if we talk about courageous practice, then that often has a bit more of a positive angle to it. And so that's what I encourage educators to do, to find the practice architectures that will enable them to be courageous in their pedagogy.
Oh, I love that. That's a beautiful way to finish. Not to take away anything that you might want to say, Leanne, do you have anything else to say?
I think that is a beautiful way to finish. There's probably one more thing that I wanted to say in terms of the theory is in the early years learning framework. But Mandy and I were looking at it the other day and it's only two lines. And it's so important to explore the theory because it is transformational. It will change fundamentally the way you do your work. But it is wherever we're thinking about changing practice, it's taking the eye off the practice itself and looking at the arrangements around it. Because we can't transform anything unless we look at all of those arrangements that enable and constrain that practice. And it's as Mandy said right at the start, it's removing that focus on that person and taking it much more broadly, what are the responsibilities of organisations in this to create those arrangements that make practice possible? And it is, you know, when we look more broadly, it is transformational.
Well, that is also a lovely way to finish as well. So well done. I think that has been an amazing conversation. I've really gotten a lot out of it. I think it's heavy going and they're big ideas, but I think, you know, that idea that we're sort of getting that sort of a bit further away perspective on things too, I think is really helpful, particularly as, you know, educators work through improving their practice and critically reflecting and all those sorts of things. So thank you both so much for your time. Is there anything you'd like to promote for if educators would like to go and find more about what you're doing?
A great question, Jackie. Absolutely, there is. So Leanne and I have a website that is all about helping people using the theory of practice architectures in early childhood education specifically. So there are some resources there for to help people. It's kind of, I guess, they're the step in the door resources. They're the mat, the welcome mat at the beginning of the practice architectures door. That's available there for anyone to go and have a look at if they're interested. Leanne and I are also available to talk with people, meet with people. We're really, really keen to get practitioners in early childhood education and care settings using the theory. We think that it's such a valuable tool for helping everybody to work through their quality improvement processes. And we potentially may have, we hope, a presentation at the Early Childhood Australia conference coming up later this year to start that journey for practitioners wanting to learn more about the theory.
Well, that sounds exciting. I'll make sure we try and get the details into our show notes. Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
You can also read our papers if you like.
Thank you so much for your time and, yeah, great conversation. And, yeah, we may touch base in the future about other topics.
Thanks so much
again,
for having us, Jackie.
Thanks, Jackie.
You're welcome. That's another episode from the Early Years Learning Hub podcast series. Thanks. Bye.